This is the House Committee on Veterans Affairs. This is Tuesday, May the 17th, 2005. And we will open a work session today on Senate Bill 486. We will not open a work session on Senate Bill 486 because we have the Honorable Senator Metzger here. We will open a work session, a public hearing and work session on Senate Joint Memorial 1. Senator Metzger, please accept our apology for the delay in...
No apology necessary, Madam Chair.
Just don't get hung in the elevator.
This is the Kale Mess System. Metzger, you notice only one missing?
I noticed that. I'm impressed. Thank you, Mr. Stamper. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and just to speak briefly on Senate Joint Memorial 1, Representative Patty Smith, and I introduced and went through the Senate. Colonel Caldwell will be here to speak on the specifics of the memorial. I just would lay out two basic principles. I've got very familiar with the National Guard. Not as familiar as Representative Boquist, but with my nephew who entered the Youth Challenge Program a couple of years ago. And
who needed that program
and came out tops in the graduating class that summer in Bend, went into the National Guard, and has been a world traveler in the Middle East ever since.
Been there, done that.
Yes. But has really matured as an individual. But I really have, on a personal level, got to feel the angst of family members serving in Iraq, and the responsibilities that have been placed on our National Guard, and the great work that they do. Senate Joint Memorial 1 speaks to this issue to the federal government, and that is, as we all know, our own National Guard has been really put to a regular test because of the numbers of individuals that have been needed to fight these battles and ensure the security and the freedoms of the Middle East, and that is due in large part because of our regular army isn't staffed sufficiently to meet all those demands, and so we've been calling upon the people across this country and the National Guards of the respective states to meet those demands, and they do an excellent job of that. However, Senate Joint Memorial 1 really gets to the heart of that issue, and to look at all the different responsibilities that we have as a nation is to really urge Congress to and the armed forces to really increase the standing army numbers of personnel, so that our National Guard people, when they come to serve, don't have to be put out as often and on such regular leave from the individual states to meet those responsibilities, and so that everyone can have a better service for the country and to the state. And they do an important job. We don't want to overtax them as individuals. We want to make sure that we have adequate resources for all of our personnel and adequate personnel to meet the demands that we have across this country. So with that, we bring you to Senate Joint Memorial 1, and if it's please you, Madam Chair, I'd ask that Colonel Caldwell come forward and maybe talk about some of the specifics.
Thank you. We certainly love to call the Colonel Caldwell, and I don't want to be remiss every committee meeting. We've always started our meeting and ask those who served in our military to stand and be recognized, and I'd like to ask that at this time, please. Those who serve our country. Thank you so much. Most grateful for your service.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Colonel Caldwell. Thank you, Senator Metzger.
Senator Metzger.
I know.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. Senator Metzger's efforts and Representative Smith's efforts to put this memorial before this distinguished body is important to the National Guard. And as you read the memorial, you will see that it's urging Congress to fund the full-time manning levels to at least 75% or 70% of what the federal government has documented as a need for full-time manning within the National Guard system. Presently, the Oregon National Guard is about 38% full-time manning of the documented need. And the way that operates, so you understand that, is that we're a traditional force, and that's not 70% of the total National Guard. In actuality, right, what it boils down to is the Guard Bureau basically looks at each state and each type of unit in the state and then determines what they believe, in a cooperative effort with the states, what they believe is the adequate manning to reach certain levels of skill and ability, training ability, readiness ability is how we term it. That need is then documented in what we term as a manning document and say this is what we would have if we had a perfect world. Well, currently right now throughout the country, and has been since prior to this, during and prior to this mobilization, these current mobilizations, is across the board, the Army National Guard has been roughly 40% of that documented need, which is typically about 10% of the total. So if you can just do the math real quickly, we're sitting at about 3 or 4 or 5% of the total number, in our case 8,000 guardsmen in, or 6,000 Army guardsmen. So we're considerably lower than we should be. What this resolution basically asks, or what this memorial asks the Congress to do, is just bring the number up to what they've already documented as a need. They just haven't funded it. The Air National Guard, on the contrary, just to show you the difference, is typically manned at about 90% of their full-time documented need. The Air National Guard is, and the reason that is because the Air Force says we want you ready to deploy within 48 hours, 72 at the most. So they have a 48-hour, 72-hour deployment schedule, and they document the full-time manning to achieve that. The Army National Guard, on the other hand, documents it at 40% of, or funds it at 40%, and our mobilization times are lengthier because of that. And we think that's not a good deal because then we have families ripped apart for, in our case, 5 and 6 months before they were deployed to Iraq for a year. So that lengthens everybody's time of deployment. So that's what this message says. This message says you need to fund what you have already recognized as a need. You need to fund it. And that's simply put.
Excuse me, please, Colonel Caldwell and Vice Chair Barnhart, let's read this memorial. It's a joint memorial to Congress. It says, to the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America and Congress assembled and the Secretary of Defense, we, your memorialists, the 73rd Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon, in legislative session assembled, respectfully represent as follows. Whereas the Army National Guard has been called a federal active duty in numbers not seen since World War II, and whereas the Oregon Army National Guard has provided 70% of its units to Operation Enduring Freedom and to Operation Iraqi Freedom, and whereas for decades, full-time manning for the Army National Guard has been underfunded and woefully neglected, and whereas the Army National Guard and the Army Reserve are currently manned at approximately 58%, and whereas it is very difficult when Army National Guard units are manned at 58% for units to maintain readiness requirements and to carry out their mission to serve this nation. And whereas a lack of full-time manning has caused the mobilization process to be extended, resulting in a longer deployment cycle for members of the Army National Guard. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon that we, the members of the 73rd Legislative Assembly, respectfully request that the Congress of the United States and the Secretary of Defense authorize and appropriate funding to attain 75% of full-time manning requirements for the Army National Guard, and that the Secretary of Defense report to Congress in the 2005 fiscal year on a plan to meet 100% of full-time manning requirements by the end of 2008. And be it further resolved that a copy of this memorial shall be sent to the President of the United States, the Secretary of Defense, and to each member of the Oregon Congressional Delegation. Vice Chair Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder, Colonel, if you could define for us what manning and full-time manning mean, because I simply don't know.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think in this particular instance, the manning and the full-time manning is a subset of the total manning picture. The full-time manning requirement, again, is documented by the National Guard Bureau. Each unit, depending on its type, like, and kind, is authorized a certain number percentage of full-time manning. For instance, in most of our units throughout the state of Oregon, we will have a company-sized element. Infantry companies typically around 140 people. Armor companies about 90 people. Out of those, of full-time, of total manning, out of that full-time manning, each one of these companies is typically three or four full-time personnel for that 90 or 100 man company, depending on what our resourcing is.
Excuse me, Colonel, when you say we have that many full-time,
correct?
But that doesn't mean full-time.
It does mean full-time. We are
They're
authorized.
Really part-time.
No. I'm saying full-time manning means out of a company-sized element of, say, Corvallis, for instance.
That has 90.
Corvallis actually is about 140-man total company.
Okay.
I just pick it out of the sky, but 140-man company. They have four full-time personnel for that 140 members.
So what
we're talking about full-time manning here is what we're talking about.
So are what we're asking for the four to be extended?
No, what we're asking for is that we believe in the government, and the Guard Bureau also has documented that for a 140-man company, there should be 8 or 10 full-time manning people.
Okay, so those are
they're only
we're
paying for four.
About.
We need 8 or 10.
I see.
And so what we're asking, this document says, if we need 10, we'll get us at least to 75% of the 10. Get us 7.5.
Okay.
We'd be better off with 7.5 than 4. So that's what we're asking for here. And those people then have the ability to work during the month to prepare training and prepare equipment and to be ready for the soldiers to come in, so we don't lose more time on a valuable weekend drill where we're doing things that if we had full-time manning to do, those could be done prior to. Therefore, the soldiers can come in and they get a more robust training environment and they get more fulfilled in the training environment. So therefore, we're not wasting time on ancillary, mundane, bureaucratic stuff. That's where the manning thing comes in. We lose that time. They're clearly not as trained. They clearly can't deploy as fast as, say, as I said earlier, the Air National Guard, who mans their people at about 40% of the total. They get 100% full-time manning, which means that's 40% of their total number. So in the company I just gave you, that would be, if that was an Air Guard unit, you would have roughly 60 people on full-time manning for that 150-man company. In the Army Guard, we've got four. So you showed you the disparity.
You would have 60 for the Air Guard.
Yeah, if that was an Air Guard company, we'd have around 60 people.
Who are paid
full-time every
that's
day.
That's their primary
their
profession and forever.
Right. Or lives.
Right. They're full-time.
Federal duty.
Federal duty. They would be paid full-time, and that's what happens in the Air Guard. In the Army Guard, they say, well, four is good. It's okay if you have 60 full-timers in the Air Guard, but in the Army Guard, you can do it with four. Well, clearly, you're not going to get as much done. I mean, it's just a simple matter of numbers and ability.
Okay. Follow up, Seth.
Could you give us an idea, based on the guard units that we have in the Army, Oregon Army National Guard now, what the difference in the number of people would be if we were manning at 75% and then 100%. Do you have a sense of what that number would be?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, we have 6,000 Army National Guardsmen. That's full-time, part-time, total manning. Out of that 6,000 right now, we have roughly 1,400 of those folks, 1,500, are full-time. So I think the math on that is what? 20%?
25%.
25%. Okay, 25%. So we are manned right now at 25% of the total documented need. the documented need of that 6,000 is somewhere in the neighborhood of probably, in our case, we would have roughly almost 3,000. No, not 3,000. We would have something less than that, around 2,500 documented, if they would fund us totally. So we're 1,000 people short across the state of Oregon.
And how long has this gone on?
Well, actually, we're in better shape now than we've been probably in my full career.
In 35 years?
Yeah. We're in better shape now than we have been. We've been inching up every year, a few slots every year. There's been some dips in there, but generally speaking, over the last 35 years, we've increased our manning levels, to full-time manning levels.
How about the number in the Guard? How has that...
The number in the Guard, we were at one time, we had 7,500 Oregon National Guardsmen. We had units that would support that. So we've actually dropped about 1,500 slots in the last 20 years. I will be honest with you, we have more deployable soldiers now than we did when we had a 7,500 man organization.
What does that mean?
It means that out of that 7,500 men, we had a lot of folks that could never deploy for one reason or another.
So better trained.
So we're better trained. We're better skilled. We have a better organization with the 6,000 than I think we did at 7,500.
What is the what is the power of this National Guard Bureau? Is it equivalent to the Army headquarters, the Air Force?
Madam Chairman, as we've discussed in this committee on numerous occasions, the National Guard, as part of the Constitution, is basically the state's militia, as stated in the Constitution. We work for the governor. The National Guard Bureau is part of the Department of Defense, and in its case, they have both a relationship with the Army and the Air Force, because we have both Air and Army Guard. So the Bureau is mainly a funding mechanism, or a guidance bureau, if you will, to give guidance to the separate states and territories, and also send funding out as long as we comply with that guidance. They don't command the Oregon National Guard or any National Guard. They have no command authority. The only commander is the commander-in-chief, in our case the governor, until we're federalized, in which case then we go to the Army. We still are not commanded by the Guard Bureau. So it's basically a bureaucratic creation to fund, to stream money, pipeline money down to the states, and pipeline guidance. And guidance being that, you know, the golden rule. You want the gold, you play by the rules. And so they monitor that federal, they monitor that federal federal dollar, and whether or not the states, the separate states, are doing it according to the way the federal government set it up. So command, no, they don't have command authority. Do they have strong? I mean, you can tell them, no, we're not going to do that. And you can do that. There's no question about that. But you may not be getting the money.
So you answer to the Secretary of Army when you're called up to Title 10?
Madam Chair, actually, no. The Secretary of the Army doesn't command either. What you answer to, basically, it starts with the President of the United States, goes down through the service chiefs, and then down to the separate commanders underneath those service chiefs.
So who would that be for us?
Well, in our case, it depends. If you're the Army, of course, you would be the chief staff. The Army has influence, who delegates that down to a sink, they call it, which is a commander-in-chief of a certain area. So the world is divided up in commands.
Regions,
if you will. The whole world is. And depending on who that four-star general is in charge, which that four-star could be an admiral, an Air Force, an Army, a Marine, doesn't matter, it's joint. And those commanders in chiefs of those areas, like NATO is a good example. That's what they call a commander in chief, the commander of NATO. And that four star is currently now, I believe, I think he's a Marine. I wouldn't swear to it, but the different services command it, because it's all services underneath that. And they will pick up the phone and call the joint chiefs and say, hey, I need X, Y, or Z, and then it's their job to resource those commanders in chief.
So is what I was getting to is this isn't every state is the same. I mean, if I went to Texas right now, they would be at 38% of the documented need.
Madam Chair, most generally it's pretty close. Some states have a little more based on what kind of units they may have. For instance, for years, New Mexico was in the air defense artillery business, rockets, you know, all this sort of thing. And New Mexico had probably 60% of their documented need, where the rest of us were struggling in around 35-32%.
So depending on the specialty.
Exactly. And that's exactly how they monitor. And New Mexico had during that period of time, back in the early 90s, they were a very high deployable unit. In other words, they were going to go faster or quicker based on the threat scenarios. They would be called quicker than, say, somebody in Hawaii might be. So Hawaii would get less resourcing, and New Mexico got more. Now, in Oregon, in our case, we've had high-priority units. So during the 90s, we actually grew some full-time people because we had high-priority units. So we were probably closer to 50% of the documented need during that period. And then they had a shift in National Guard Bureau had a shift in consciousness and decided that they were going to make everybody equal again. Different leadership at the Bureau, so then they cut people like Oregon and New Mexico, and they states that had 15% of the documented need went up, and states like Oregon went down. So it's basically a policy decision from the Pentagon that determines this. It's basically a policy decision that you think is vetted out with the different service chiefs, the different war scenarios. That's the theory. And I suspect generally that's how they manage it. The real issue is that they've never funded the Army National Guard's full-time manning needs, period. They have the Air Force, because the Air Force service chief said, this is important to us. These people are important to our overall goals. So therefore, we're going to fund them because we want them quickly. We want them trained and we want them quickly. So we're going to fund the full-time manning levels. The Army Guard said no. We believe that the Army National Guard and the reserve components in generally, the Army, they determined that the reserve components were deep reserve for a Cold War scenario that envisioned, you know, the Soviet hordes coming across the German plains. And therefore, they said, we will take care of it with our 15 Army divisions. And once we can't get there from here, we've got X amount of days then to mobilize guardsmen and reservists and get them into the fight. Well, clearly, that whole scenario has changed. We've seen that in the last 5, 6, 7 years. But the manning levels haven't. Philosophy's changed and how we utilize reserve components, but we haven't. The Congress has not seen fit to man the reserve components appropriately.
So is this one reason we're closing the bases?
Madam Chair, there's the base realignment and closure is basically part of that whole global war scenario that the certified smart people at the Pentagon dream up, and they.
they got this figured out.
I've got this.
You can hear the quote marks around that. Yes, yeah. Madam Chair.
And the certificate from the Cracker Jack
box. Right. So the planners have now determined that that they do not need as many Air Force flying units, combat units, jet units, because of the age of equipment and because of their desire to harvest funds, if you will, to pay for the F-22 and the F-35. They clearly believe that the what they call the legacy aircraft, in this case, which is the F-16, is going to go out of service because of its age and its capability. The F-15 will remain. And so in order to do that, they figure they don't need all of these bases. In our case, here in Oregon, where we've had a realignment, not a closure, up in Portland, we are presenting our proposal, which we have been doing for a year, as to what we believe is necessary for the mission that we have out of Portland. We do not think that this particular announcement that was made on Friday is adequate. We don't think that it meets those needs, and we've forwarded that to our congressional delegation, and we've prepared some documents and preparing some more documents and to the governor's office to get them to come online and argue that point. And the point, if you look at what, and we're off on a tangent here, but if you will indulge me for a moment, I can probably give you more than you want to know, but if you look at what came out on Friday, the proposal was to basically take the jets, the equipment, 18 F-15s from the Portland Air Base, and redistribute those, 9 of them to Louisiana and 9 of them to New Jersey. And both New Jersey and Louisiana have similar like-and-kind units. Almost, they're identical units to the one that's in Portland. Those two units do exactly what they do in Portland, which is air sovereignty for the continental United States. And basically that is protection to you and me and to everybody else for unauthorized flying planes to be coming into our area. And that's our primary mission, is to run alert. So it seems rather illogical in our mind that you would say, I need 9 additional airplanes in Louisiana to take them from 18 to 24 airplanes, and 9 additional airplanes in New Jersey to take them from 18 to 24 airplanes. But in Portland, we can do it with 3 or 4. And we have the same mission they have, which is air sovereignty of the continental United States and the coast and the region. So we're perplexed. We presented a plan that we thought would lower the footprint or shrink the footprint of the Air National Guard in Oregon, but still provide adequate manning and jets for the mission of air sovereignty on the northwest corner of the United States of America. And they rejected the plan, said we'll take the airplanes and we'll give you back maybe 3 or 4 other airplanes. And we're just totally perplexed. We don't understand that.
So who on the West Coast picks this up, this mission?
The plan right now, as we understand it, and we're not really sure about that because it's not been, we've had conversations verbal. We've not seen anything in writing. And until you see it in writing, you can't guarantee it, is that they would have what's termed a detachment of another unit. We think either out of Fresno, or they would take a detachment out of Klamath Falls and put it in Portland, and that would be a detachment of 3 or 4 jets to do this continental United States air sovereignty mission. So why does it take 24 airplanes in New Jersey and 24 airplanes in Louisiana to do what we can do in the Northwest with 3 or 4? That's our question. We said we don't get the logic here. So somebody help us out with this logic. Now, in reality, what happened?
Political.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Very political.
Yeah, it's political inside, more so inside the Pentagon, and I think, than the normal politics you would think about. What we think happened here was that Air Force basically came out and said, listen, we're going to get rid of a lot of F-16 units, which is a single jet engine airplane, and the F-15's got 2 engines. We're going to get rid of these airplanes. They're older. And so those of you that have them won't have anything to fly. And perfectly good Air Force units, Air Guard units. Those of you that have F-15s and you've got 2 units in your state, you will not have 2 units in your state flying units, which we have in Oregon. We have Klamath Falls, which is a schoolhouse, teaches people how to fly airplanes. And we have Portland, which has got a mission to take care of air sovereignty. So if you have 2, you're going to lose 1. Mm-hmm. No other reason than geographics don't seem to matter here. And we said, well, fine. We can understand why you want to try to distribute the, you know, what's left out to people that are going to lose, get go to nothing. But if you're going to do that, here's a plan that we think will work for Oregon in the Northwest, which is keep Klamath Falls doing what they do, teach people how to fly, and we will add... We propose a number of airplanes greater than 3, let's put it that way. We will add those to that unit and then detach them back up to Portland. In other words, they never leave. We just move the flags around. We move the headquarters, like the corporate headquarters just moved. You know, the corporate headquarters moved down to Klamath Falls, and the satellite headquarters is still in Portland. We reduce the number of jets for Oregon, which is what their objective was, and we still do the mission. And when they came out with this new proposal, we were just stunned on Friday. We were absolutely stunned. We did not anticipate they would do this. So we're asking...
Has anybody else, this happened to anybody else besides
Well,
us?
Some states have lost their entire flying units. I mean, they have nothing. They have no replacements. They have no F-15s or 16s to fly. They're just completely out of business. What is it? The air base in South Dakota, 3,000 jobs. I think they're B-1 bombers, and they totally said, you're gone, we're closing the base. So from a, you know, I guess from a practical standpoint, you know, the good news is they didn't close anything in Oregon. The bad news is they took a bigger hunk than we think is really safe, and we think it's not very smart.
So as a nation, as a whole, what's the reduction of our air coverage?
Well, Madam Chairman, in our case, it seems that the biggest chunk of reduced coverage is in the Pacific Northwest, because they're robusting the South Coast, they're robusting the East Coast, they're adding there, and they're sucking out of the Northwest to do that. That's the end result. Huh. And again, we're struggling with this logic.
Well,
and we've informed
too.
Both of our senators and all of our delegation of this very thing. We're saying, we don't get it. Maybe you can get some answers. We don't understand it.
Would it be possible that, without putting your job in jeopardy?
Well, I work for the governor, Madam Chairman. So
okay, well, good. Can we get a document that says, whereas this has happened, so we word it right, so we could all send, I could ask all the senators and representatives to...
Madam Chair, we'd be delighted to do that.
I've been helped, but
well, absolutely.
It hurt.
And we met on Friday, we met over the weekend, and we met again yesterday, forming a position paper, if you will.
Oh, good.
So we hope to have that available not later than Friday of this week. We had several meetings. We've been meeting a lot, trying to refine this our response. And that response we intended to share with elected leaders of this state and with other interest groups, Port of Portland, you know, the mayor, other folks that have a vested interest in this outcome. So we are preparing that. Again, I hope to have it. We hope to have it accomplished by Friday.
Okay.
And we will distribute that freely and widely. And we appreciate any support that you might feel compelled to give.
Great. Questions of the colonel? Okay. Well, this concerns us. I know it does me, and I'm sure it does the whole committee. And so we'll do our best to support you and the citizens. That's our primary purpose.
Well, we certainly appreciate it. Again, this joint memorial is... every state in the union has been asked to to do this to our respective congressional representatives. So the message comes forth from all of the states in the union, and this is in line with that objective, because we think it's important, and we think it's important that we do the best job we can do to make sure our soldiers are as well trained as they can possibly be if and when they're called to active duty. And as we've seen over the last couple of years, that's a fairly regular item. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Colonel Caldwell. And is there any other individual who wishes to testify? Okay.
I think we opened the work session, is that right?
Yeah. Okay. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Joint Memorial 1 to the floor with the do adopt recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Farr. Representative Farr has moved the Senate Joint Memorial 1 to the House floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Aaron, please.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Bolton.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative
Clinton.
Aye.
Representative
Tom.
Aye.
Chair Nelson.
Aye. Senate Joint Memorial 1 has passed this committee onto the floor to be adopted and unanimously. And I'll close the public hearing work session on Senate Joint Memorial 1, open a work session on Senate Bill 486.
I wanted to ask a question, Madam Chair, about Senate Joint Memorial 1. Is there someone that you would like to lead the floor debate?
Well, I'm sure Patty Smith would be the one. If that's okay. Is everybody?
Yes.
And Madam Chair, if I might, when Senator Metzger was here, I kind of motioned to the committee. I was before you arrived, I was telling him how dutiful House committees are about being present and attentive, as compared to some other chambers. And so I wanted to point out to him before he left that there were seven of you listening very attentively to his testimony.
Okay, great. And I do apologize once again for having that little delay. I really disliked that, and it happened. So I do apologize to everyone. All right, on Senate Bill 486, I'll accept a motion. Representative Barnhart.
Madam Chair, I move...
Senate Bill 486 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Barnhart has moved Senate Bill 46 to the House floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Aaron?
Representative Boker.
Yes.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Chair Nelson.
Aye. Senate Bill 46 is passed this committee unanimously, and we'll move on to the House floor. Carrier. Oh, Representative Farr, thank you.
Are you sure that our speaker wouldn't like to carry back them herself?
I don't think so.
Oh, right. I'd be happy to.
You said the speaker. Were you meaning the chair?
Well, I noticed that the bill was...
Oh, is it the speaker's bill? Well, why don't we put a co-carry just in case?
Sure.
How's that?
That sounds great.
Okay. That would be a good idea. Okay. Thank you very much, members. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 486. And I want to ask, is there any testimony regarding... any subject today? Any other subject we need to get to? Committee members, there will be no meeting on Thursday. Enjoy that morning off, and then expect a lot of work the next week. If you will, please, if we get some of these bills out of areas that they shouldn't be in right now, which we're working on throughout the system. So, have a nice day off, and thank you for your commitment to the veterans of this state. I will now close this House committee meeting.